Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, March 29th, 2022, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts for the evening, Lavendar and Anastasia. If you've registered for the Pleiadian lineup Starseed Quest in May, be sure to check your email for important info before this Friday so you don't lose your spot. And the next quest will be August 12th through 15th. So our special guest this evening is author Cheryl Costa, who will talk about her new book, Magical Musings of a Rogue Witch. When a pagan priestess or priest retires from pastoral duties with a circle, coven, or clan, there is an expectation that they will write a book about their life in the craft. Some write books of spells, others the art of managing craft-oriented groups of people, still others write a memoir about their life in the craft. Cheryl chose to write an alternative and non-sectarian view of the theory of mystical physics and applied magical and divination mechanics. This is not a list of spells and types of crystals to purchase. Instead, she explains how to seek within the self to tap and enhance your mystical powers. Magic is about shaping reality. The basic technique of magic is simple enough in theory. It only requires communicating our intention from our talking self to the younger self to the great consciousness, higher self, for manifestation. Magic isn't hard, and it isn't easy either. Practicing the art of magic requires training, focus, practice, discipline, and a flexibility to adapt. Ponder for a moment the idea that reality is a construct, therefore, it's bendable and malleable. Furthermore, consider that real-life mystics have been massaging reality's pliable points using metaphysical techniques for millennia. You can find Cheryl's book on Amazon. At the top of the show, it's Anastasia's Starseed News, bringing topics of interest to starseeds not heard in the mainstream. And at the top of the show, oops, I already said that, do you have starseed children or grandchildren? Are you constantly trying to get them off the screens? I know it's a big problem for many, so I've recently written a book to help children want to put the phone down and reconnect with Mother Nature by understanding the animal guides of Native America. It's called Magical Messages from the Animal Kingdom, and it is also on Amazon. And you can just type Arielle Taylor in the search bar, and you'll get right to it. And we'd like to thank Kathy and Fiona for hosting the switchboard tonight. And on our main website, we have available the Stage 1 Starseed Confirmations, which are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one Zoom session available with either Anastasia, Emerald, Miara, Riley, or myself. Lavendar has now retired from doing sessions so she can concentrate on finishing her book and continue to write for starseeds. And remember, if you have a birthday coming up, you're going to get a window of 10 hours of power. You can find out exactly when that happens just by requesting your solar return timing. And that usually takes less than a week, so well before your birthday, you can ask for that. So first up this evening, let me switch my screen back. I would like to there's Anastasia. Introduce Anastasia with her Starseed News.
Well, hello, Arielle. Good evening, everybody. It's great to be with you. We've got lots of news. It's a beautiful spring day here. I hope you're enjoying this change in the seasons. The daffodils are up and the red buds are starting to bud, and it's beautiful. Well, I want to start out tonight's story by a really amazing unselfish act. This is a story about a Olympic medalist. She won the silver. Her name is Maria Andrzejczyk, and she's 25 years old. She captured the silver medal for javelin at the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games. It was a triumph over the odds when she did that, however, because she missed a medal opportunity at the 2016 Rio Games. She was only 2 centimeters short of that, and she'd also overcome shoulder surgery in 2017 and another health crisis in 2018 before she could compete again in 2020. So she went through a lot to earn this medal. But it just so happens that she heard about a fundraiser for an 8-month-old boy who was born with a serious heart defect, and she felt inspired to help this boy beat the odds as well. Now, his family needed $380,000 to perform a life-saving operation that would be performed in Barcelona, Spain. They'd already raised half from their own campaign to raise money, but they were running out of time. She said, "It didn't take me long to decide." What was it that she was deciding? Well, it was to auction off her Olympic medal to raise the remaining money for this little boy to have his heart surgery.
Oh, wow.
She did that. She put her Olympic medal up for auction with a winning bid of $125,000 that came from a Polish supermarket chain. They bought the medal, but guess what they did? They later told the young Olympic medalist that she could keep her medal, even though they had paid for it.
Oh.
So what a story. She was willing to sacrifice this to bring life to a child and a supermarket chain that did a good deed and didn't take her medal but helped the child anyway. That's
wow. Wonderful.
Well, there is all kinds of news out about the movement towards green energy and the environment, cleaning up the environment. It's just remarkable. I mean, one could easily feel dismal realizing all of the pollution problems, environmental problems we have. We are not told about all the work that's doing to solve these problems. And I've got news for you. It's not impossible, by no means whatsoever. Let's start with a story about renewable energy in steel. Now, when companies burn coal to produce steel, they spew carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that amounts to about 9% of all direct emissions from fossil fuels, and that is 2.6 gigatons of carbon dioxide. That's a lot. Now, one Swedish company has figured out how to make steel without coal. It's a company in Stockholm, SSAB, they're called. And they have recently announced that they have produced the world's first fossil fuel-free steel. How did they do it? They're using hydrogen and electricity from renewable energy sources. Automakers Volvo and Mercedes-Benz have signed up for the first deliveries of this steel, and the steel company hopes to be able to produce this coal-free steel on an industrial scale by 2026. So in the future, you'll be driving an automobile that has been made with carbon-free steel. Remarkable.
Wow.
Also, there's a man in Ireland who grew up kayaking around the southwest coast. He's 20 years old. His name is Fionn. And as he was growing up, he saw and witnessed the devastating effects of ocean pollution firsthand. Clear up in Ireland and the northern countries, they have pollution as well. He was shocked by the amount of plastic that was on the shores, so he applied himself to learn more about the estimated 300 million tons of plastic waste that we produce every year. Now, the most dangerous form of plastic, as he discovered, is the kind that we can't see. That's microplastics, which are tiny fragments that end up in fish and in our bodies. And they tell us that on the average, each human being ingests 5 grams of microplastics every week, about the equivalent of a credit card. And we get that from the food that we eat and the water that we drink. But that's not the only source. We even pick up more microscopic plastic particles from carpets and synthetic textiles. Well, after he noticed that oil spill residue on the beach attracted plastic particles, Fionn set out to design a device that uses ferrofluid, which is a type of magnetic liquid, to remove microplastics from drinking water. And in 2019, his prototype, which removed 87% of microplastics from a water sample, won him the grand prize at the Google Science Fair. He's now a chemistry student at the University of Groningen, excuse me, and he's working with an Ohio-based company to fine-tune his invention for use in houses and potentially in wastewater treatment plants. He said, "I love the process of inventing and doing things for the planet, and I have many more ideas in my head."
Wow.
And many countries around the world are now abandoning fossil fuels for renewable energy sources. People are wondering, what are we going to do with the toxic landscapes that are being left behind? There is so much to clean up. And Norway is one very good idea. It has decided to turn the country's last Arctic coal mine, located along the archipelago between Norway and the North Pole, they're going to turn that into a nearly 3,000 square kilometer natural park. Now, this area that had been coal mined was already of vital ecological importance because 20 million birds nest on the islands during the summer, while about 3,000 polar bears use its sea ice as prime hunting grounds. So now this will be a brand new national park that is going to unify this wilderness, and over time, they say it will return to a pristine and well-managed eco environment. So turning it back to nature. And
wow.
Also, there is really a move now to get away from stuff, okay, buying new stuff, our consumption. And this is an attempt to reuse products, what we get when we go to secondhand stores. The fact is that fast fashion, same-day shipping, and planned obsolescence into products, making them to wear out. Well, nowadays, we expect things to be delivered quickly, but we know better than to expect them to last. Well, the United Kingdom, for example, generated 222 million tons of waste in 2018. That was almost 4 years ago. But a grassroots operation in Glasgow called Remade, and it was founded by a former environmental activist, by the way, wants to alter that thinking. So what they do is they collect all of this used stuff, and they have technicians on hand to help people mend, repair, and reuse everything that they have, from laptops to lamps, from jeans, slacks, jumpers, dresses, you name it, they'll fix it for a modest fee. Customers can also buy refurbished computers and other gadgets or go to workshops to learn how to repair and restore their own items. They tell us that in a throwaway world, this company Remade is a keeper. And
yeah.
These stories are everywhere. There are numerous countries that are starting up movements for this. It's really going to become a thing of the future. And that means I have to ask myself, what are manufacturers going to do? They'll probably be forced, number one, eventually, into making quality items that keep as they used to. I still have a toaster that's 40 years old and it works just fine. That's older than a lot of our listeners. But, there was a time when they made things and they worked. Anybody who's collected antiques, such as perhaps an old meat grinder or goodness knows what, you can name anything, that's 200 years old, still works fine. Put a little oil to it and it works great. So this is fairly new that things have not lasted long. It's manufacturers who decided that, hey, we can make more money if we can sell more stuff, and we'll just fix it so they don't last too long. And everything we buy is made like that, and it's actually planned for. It's called functional obsolescence. They know they're doing it, and nobody's complained. People keep buying. Well, here's a resistance movement against that very thing. To remake things, to reuse things, eventually they'll have to give in and clean up their act and begin to make things that last. And the result will be we won't have to be buying things over and over again. I can tell you, over the past decade, I've probably averaged 2 coffee pots a year. And I don't think I'm the only one. Coffee pots are famous to break down and throw out. So this is a trend away from these things to save the world of the garbage and save natural resources. I think it's wonderful. In Romania, Romania, like the Ukraine and other countries in that part of the world, have really difficult histories. These people have gone through so much. And in Romania specifically, there is a certain architect who grew up during this really rough time in Romania. and after decades of communist dictatorship. They had a bumpy transition to a free market society, but people were economically desperate. And when this boy was this man, or he was a boy then, when he was 16 in the mid-90s, he witnessed fleets of cars filled with antique furniture, ceramics, traditional costumes. They were leaving and being shipped out of the country to be sold in the West. He was outraged at the pillaging of his nation's heritage. And he and his brother began to collect or buy whatever valuable objects they could find. I mean, this is not unusual. During World War II, we saw that Europe lost much of its treasure as it was shipped out. That people had nothing, they had to sell everything that they had. Well, this happened in Romania. This young man saw it. He knew it wasn't right. At a very young age, he started to collect things. Well, now he's really expanded his mission. He's turned it into his life's work. And just a few years ago, he founded something called the Ambulance for Monuments. It started with a truck that was loaded with tools that wandered all over the land of Romania, repairing neglected historical buildings and monuments with the help of volunteers. So now it's 5 years later. He has 7 trucks, 500 volunteers, and has saved 60 traditional structures, including medieval churches, ancient windmills, and castles. There are sponsors for this, of course. One of them is Prince Charles Educational Charity, called the Princess Foundation, which is bankrolling the project. But local communities also donate food and housing to volunteers, and their governments are supplying construction materials. The end result is heritage is being rescued from oblivion. But also, there is now a renewed interest in Romania's history. People need their roots. They need a connection to their past. Well, his organization estimates that there are still about 600 monuments in Romania that need help, and he would love to see his efforts reproduced in other countries as well. Well, here's somebody who's not thinking about themselves. He knows his mission. He's doing it. It's beautiful. And I don't know how many of you ever watched or remember the Looney Tunes. This is, goes way, way back. Cartoons, clear back in the 60s and before. Sometimes went into the 70s. But there was a character called the Tasmanian Devil. He gave Bugs Bunny a hard time. Well, that's all any, you know, most people nowadays think of the Tasmanian Devil. They think of the cartoon character because it was ubiquitous in American culture at the time. Now, there is a real-life Tasmanian Devil. It's an animal, and it's actually one of the world's most vulnerable marsupials. It was devastated by a facial tumor disease that wiped out 90% of the population in some areas of Tasmania, and they were declared an endangered species way back in 2008. Well, now Tasmanian devils are thriving on the Australian mainland for the first time in 3,000 years, thanks to the efforts of a conservation group called Aussie Arc. They say dozens of devils were introduced to a 400-hectare sanctuary in New South Wales last year, and this spring, the first generation of new baby joeys were born. Once widespread over the entire continent, prehistoric climate change combined with hunting by people and dingoes left Tasmania the only place where devils survived after 1000 BC. This is an ancient animal. So Aussie Arc hopes to create a self-sustaining population of Tasmanian devils that can help rebalance the ecosystem in the face of invasive species. Something that we don't often think about is that every single species has a purpose in the greater whole. When we lose one, there's a chain reaction. Other species suffer, and it does change the entire ecosystem. So putting them back where they belong and letting them grow and prosper restores the balance of the earth in that area.
Great.
How many of you have had the frustration of maybe you're going to a wedding. I don't know what you're doing, but you're dressed up. You have on your nice shoes, okay, and you step out on the city sidewalk. Oh, maybe it's a new pair of shoes. You really like your shoes. You step out of the car, and you stepped into a big pile of chewing gum. It's not easy to get off, and our habit of chewing gum is not without its toll on the environment. Did you know, I didn't, that most gum is made from synthetic polymers like plastic, and it's not biodegradable. Don't swallow your gum, people. And as they say, that's why so much discarded gum seems to permanently stick to sidewalks. Well, to help tackle that problem, there have been some entrepreneurs that have created their own plastic-free alternative. It's called True Gum. It was launched in 2017, and it makes 400,000 pieces of plastic-free chewing gum a day in Copenhagen. Each piece of True Gum has a chicle base, a resin that Mayan and Aztec peoples were chewing hundreds of years ago. Now people in such countries as the Netherlands, Germany, and Belgium are True Gum chewers. So they say if this eco-friendly gum catches on, it could spell the end of gum-spotted sidewalks the world over. I didn't know gum had plastic in it. Did you, Ariel?
No.
I bet
no,
you
I'm shocked.
No, you didn't? No,
I'm shocked. I am too.
Well, there you have it. And you've all heard about the problem with wind turbines and birds. They tell us that's one of the negative effects of onshore wind farms is bird deaths. Well, a 9-year study at Norway's wind farm, the name of the wind farm is Smola, it's found that bird strikes can be eliminated by up to 70% by simply painting one blade of a wind turbine the color black. Scientists believe this reduces what they call motion smear, allowing birds to see the three rotating blades. The researchers tell us that further tests at other wind farms should be needed, but that's where they think it's going. Paint one blade black, and the birds will find their way through it without being injured. I think that's pretty significant.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay, how are we doing on time? I have a couple of really cute stories, and I don't want to run over. I'll share this one with you. The art of conversation lives on. Well, in front of Barcelona's Arc de Triomphe, a 26-year-old sets up two fold-away chairs and puts up a sign with large letters that reads, "Free conversations." Anyone's welcome to stop, sit, and chat with him in Spanish, English, or Catalan about anything they like. The young man says the idea is to just talk freely for a while. Well, he's a 26-year-old writer and storyteller, and he says, "We have lost the art of conversation. We live in a world where it's often easier to send a text message to someone from another country than to say good morning to our neighbors." Well, as he runs his little sidewalk boutique talking to people, he posts photos of himself and those who choose to chat, and he shares their reflections and sometimes their startling revelations. He said at times he feels like a therapist. He said, "You hear good, positive stories and some really tough ones too. A lot of people will tell you about a tricky episode in their life, maybe a heartbreak or a job loss. There's a bit of everything." A 70-year-old Lithuanian woman even talked about the years she spent in a Russian concentration camp. Well, during the coronavirus situation, he took the conversation online. He set up a website called randompenpals.com. It's a site that invites users to get a quarantine pen pal in 10 seconds. He plans to publish a manifesto and aims to spread his initiative to other major cities around the world. Sit down and have a talk. Tell me what you're thinking and feeling. I'm listening. And here, I'll make this our last story for tonight. This is adorable. Gosh, it's one of those that you really kind of need a picture. So what I did was, as I'm going to read this to you, I left the website open so that I can read the photograph on the air to you about what this says. So let me share the story, and then I'll share with you the sentiments. In about 2 seconds, you'll know what I'm talking about. Okay, a second grade teacher created a writing assignment for her students that is helping local shelter animals find forever homes. The teacher asked her students at St. Michael's Episcopal School in Richmond, Virginia, to draw pictures of animals at the Richmond Animal Care and Control, RACC, and then write letters from the perspectives of the animals themselves to try and help get them adopted. She was telling the children to be mouthpieces for the animals, write it down, how do the dogs and cats feel, why should anybody adopt me? Well, the class, she said, was working on persuasive writing, and they wrote pieces as if they were speaking on behalf of a shelter dog trying to get adopted. Each student was assigned a dog or cat from the shelter and then was briefed on the background and temperament of the animal. Then they put the written letters and pictures, that's the part I can't share with you. The children wrote, drew adorable pictures of these animals, along with a note at the bottom. And those pictures and letters were hung on the outside of each animal's kennel. Well, she said, this classroom project collaboration allowed me to combine my two greatest passions, children's literacy and helping animals in need. She said, I am so proud to see my students rise to the occasion and write amazing persuasive paragraphs through the eyes of one of their dogs. So now I'm going to read to you these notes. So bear with me. See. Okay, I'll start here. And this is a picture with a blue sky and a sun, a green meadow, and a little doggy sitting there. The child wrote, Hi, my name is Yosemite. I am a boy. I like the animal shelter, but you would be best. If you're looking for a pet, please, please, please take me home. It would really make my day if you adopted me. I love cuddles, kisses, and extra love. I'm begging you, please adopt me.
Uh-huh.
Letter number two. Hi, I am Gail Weathers. I would like a home so much. I have a fine life here, but I would like my own dog bed a lot. I would like a toy and a big yard. I would like to be the only pet in the home. Third letter. Hi, my name is Sleigh Ride. Do you want to adopt me? You can train me if you want. Can you put a heart on my collar? I am a girl. Who are you? You can snuggle with me. I promise that I will be a good dog. You can even sleep with me if you want. I love going on walks and playing outside. I am a medium-sized dog. I am getting bored of this place. Would you love me forever? Love, a cute puppy.
Aww.
And finally, hello, my name is Sunday Special. I would love to be adopted. If you do adopt me, I hope I will brighten up your Sundays like the sun. You'll be my Sunday Special, and I hope I'll be yours.
Aww.
From the beautiful heart of a child, 8 animals were quickly adopted after their stories were written and read. Oh, how sweet. How sweet.
That's great.
There is sweetness and beauty and wonder and love all around us. It is wonderful to be alive. Each day is a gift. From my heart to each one of you, much love, everybody. Have a beautiful couple of weeks, and I'll catch you next time. Thanks, Ariel.
Oh, thank you so much. Great stories tonight. We really appreciate it. So we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Sure.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, now we are going to get Lavendar and our special guest, Cheryl Costa. Let me get your mics open. Okay, are you all ready to go?
Yep.
I'm ready.
Okay, take it away.
So, Cheryl, are you there?
Yep.
Well, first of all, I wanted to comment on a book that you had written earlier called UFO Sighting Desk Reference Book, of which you sent to me, and I really love this book. And I realized that when I saw your picture, I went, oh, that's right. She wrote that other wonderful reference book. So I wanted to ask you, have you been able to get it to all of the people in Congress or to different libraries? What's happening with this wonderful UFO desk reference book?
Okay, what we had to get it to certain people, obviously. There's a lobbyist in D.C., a guy by the name of Steve Bassett, and we made sure he got a few copies to use as necessary. And the other thing we did was this past summer, we took a copy of the desk reference, 2 copies, and I generated our database now can go down to the zip code level. Okay, so for any state. So the head of the Senate Select Intel Committee at that time was Senator Rubio, and he had a counterpart in the House as well. It was a New York State representative. And I generated a printout of each of their state's sightings for 20 years, right down to the zip code level, which zip codes are a big deal with politicians. And in both cases, they were about an inch and a half thick, along with my book. It was about a 5-pound package both of them got from us. And we had a very terse cover letter, only about half a page. We basically gave them the high-level executive summary of how many sightings there were in the United States in the last 20 years, citing reports rather, and said, hey, if you guys decide to have congressional hearings, we are the civilian experts on the statistics. Please feel free to invite us.
So did they invite you?
They haven't. COVID has tied up everything getting out of that, so to speak, and they haven't gotten around to it. The usual suspects in D.C. who are doing the lobby work, say it's in a holding pattern right now, but it's gonna come out sooner or later. They're gonna do something. It's just right now there's too much other business to deal with, and that's pretty much where it sits. Now, the book you got was bright fuchsia pink, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. A quick story on that. In 2019, of course, we didn't know COVID was coming. The usual suspects, these are our lobby people down there, they reached out to us and said, hey, you ladies wrote the only book of statistics ever published on UFOs. And we said, yeah, okay. And they said, well, would you be prepared to testify before Congress? Because Senator Rubio was trying to get a bill tagged onto something that would pass that would call for that sort of thing and being more square with the American people. And we said, yeah, sure, we could do that if necessary. Okay. Now, please understand, Linda and I both were contractors to the government, and you spend your entire career doing your best not to be called in front of Congress, And so we said, yeah, sure. So after we got off the phone, we sat there and thought about this. And we were getting ready to compile the 2001 to 2020 version. This is in the middle of 19. We had to wait until 2020 was over with. And it dawned on us, okay, if we end up in front of Congress and there's going to be congressmen or senators up there thumbing through papers and things, we want people to know, one, that's our book they're thumbing through, and two, as women UFO researchers, we wanted people to know it was women who produced this book. Okay? So we decided to make it bright fuchsia, something you can flag in an aircraft with. And so it's adoringly being called the Pink Book. So Project
Pink Book.
The Air Force had Project Blue Book. We have Project Pink Book.
I love that. I want you to know that this is such a reference book. Everyone should have one of these if they're really interested in the discovery of the truth about the different states that have more UFO sightings than others. And as I was going through it, I went, most of these things happen, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I noticed.
Actually, the peak time is between 8:30 at night and 10:30 at night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I noticed here in Arkansas, it was 3 a.m. That's the one I was looking.
Okay, Arkansas, there's a special story there. There's a peak after midnight. It goes, the sightings fall off steeply, and there's a bump at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we attribute that to early morning dog walkers that first smoke, going outside, brushing the snow off the car, that kind of thing. Okay. Arkansas had a bump at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I was presenting down at the 2019 Ozarks UFO conference, Ozark Mountain UFO conference. And I had about 12 men come up to me afterwards. I told them I didn't know what that 3 a.m. peak was about. And he came up to me, and all 12 of these guys said, well, we're chicken farmers. We raise a lot of chickens here in Arkansas, and that's when we prep our birds to go to market.
there's your 3 o'clock. Okay.
They're outside. And so you got to be outside to have this availability to see this stuff. And we found in Vegas, there was a bump at 1, 2, and 4. I sent a copy of this out to the MUFON investigator out there, and she called me up and says, hey, that's when the clubs and the shows let out. So this is about leisure time when you're outside, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, bravo, bravo, bravo.
Thank you.
To you and your partner for doing this book, because I think this is going to be a major key when everything gets turned loose here pretty soon. I think that this reference book is the fact book. You know, you can't argue with facts when they're in black and white the way you've presented them.
Numbers don't lie, as they say.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But that's not really why we invited you this time on the show.
Yes.
So let's get to the new book that you've written, The Magical Musings of a Rogue Witch. I love this title so much. It makes me laugh to know that you've probably gone the extra mile to really know about this. For someone to say that you're a rogue witch, that you've got my vote already. Okay.
The original, the working title we had originally with the first manuscript was The Magical Ravings of a Mad Witch. And my publisher sat me down and said, look, people are going to think you're stark, raking, loony, and you've written a very sensible book here. So can we do something different? So we came up with this one of the fact that I've always cut my own path in craft. And so that's how come we came up with the one of Magical Musings of a Rogue Witch, somebody who was always a bit of a maverick.
Well, the thing that I love about this book is that it points you in the direction of being able to really step into the art of bending reality.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key to your book, is at least telling people that this is a reality, that you can bend space and time. And that is the machine code that you write about in your book. So tell us a little bit more about how you discovered this.
Well, okay. I think the first part of it is that I learned a long time ago that term bending reality was in Starhawk's 1982 book, Spiral Dance. And that image and that mindset always stayed with me. But the problem for me was when I was teaching, I always felt that we were teaching magic backwards. It always seemed people were starting out with spell casting, especially if they were in a circle or had somebody teaching them or something like this. And there were a lot of people you bumped into and you ask them if they did divination and they, I don't monkey with that. Okay. And my argument down the line had for about the last 20 years had been, you have to really develop a good connection with your younger self to make the nonverbal communication to make it all happen with the higher self. And so I started teaching it the other way around, teaching a divination process to get there and meditation and quieting the mind, which is key to this stuff, is you have to quiet. I mean, people ask me, well, wait a minute, we quiet our mind. I said, yeah, but witches for generations have been doing it by crystal balls or staring into a candle magic, whatever, to kind of numb their consciousness down a bit to do this. And I say, well, we've got modern techniques for meditation that can put you in the zone very quickly. So why not use the modern techniques? Pretty much my approach. The other aspect of it is that, you know, I've had people push back, but, oh, we want the old ways. And I said, wait a minute, does that necessarily mean the old ways are always the best? I said, a Model T Ford and I got a 2022 Maserati sitting here. Which one is better? You know? So that's kind of how we got there.
Wow. Wow. So tell us a little bit about your early life, because I'm sure that you were born with very awake consciousness. Can you tell us anything at all about some of your earlier life or things that you've experienced that you think our audience would like to hear?
Well, okay. Not that everybody has to be like this, believe me. Clairvoyance runs down the maternal side of my family. And most of my cousins that had the gift, and my brother and sister, they ignored it, buried it, ran away from it. Okay. It was only like two, three of us that embraced it. Okay. And that was the big deal. We embraced it. So I was forced to go to Catholic school as a kid. Because my mother was a convert, so to speak. So they required that the kid go to school. And my brother and sister went to public school, because after the experience of what I went through, and the nuns wouldn't come through me with a 10-foot, wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole after they figured out I was clairvoyant. And I saw the world very differently. And that was an issue. I had a grandmother who was a spiritualist church person, high up in their local chapter of it. And so I was exposed to that stuff as a kid, 5, 6, 7 years old, that type of thing. So I always had a much more open view of reality as they taught. Now, much later on, okay, I left Catholic school in sixth grade. I left Catholicism when I was 17. I went in the service right out, the Air Force right out of high school. And I wasn't a Catholic anymore at that point. And I went to, when I was in the Air Force, and down in Texas for about a year, everybody in the barracks, I went to church with everybody. I wanted to hear what everybody had. I went to more tent revivals, more river baptisms than you can shake a stick at. Went to all the Mormon dinners and watched all the movies from the Mormon missionaries. Okay. I went with everybody. Nothing sang to me. I later was in Vietnam. And when I was in Vietnam, some Native American guys I worked with pointed out two things to me. One, this was Boy Cheryl in the Air Force, and they looked at me and they said, "You're two souls." I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Don't worry, Coyote will tell you all about it someday." And that monkey crawled up on my back sometime later. But the bottom line was, they also noticed that I had a different sight on things, and so people have always noticed that I saw the world differently. And so when I got in the Navy, about 6, 7 years later, I got in the Navy. I wasn't done doing what I was doing. The only reason I got out of the Air Force is my hometown got wiped out in a flood in 1972, or Agnes Hurricane. So I got out to help my family get back on their feet. And then I went back in the service. And I got into a Navy program. It was 2 years worth of school. And when I got out onto a nuclear submarine, after they spent 2 years training me in some very special work, I met a guy, he had a pentacle hanging around his neck, and I asked him, "Gee, are you a Satanist?" And he came down my throat, "No, I'm Wiccan." So we got to be friends, and he gave me things to read, and the Wicca thing that I was reading from the early Gardnerian work was resonating with me. But I was a solitaire for the next number of years. This is in the mid-70s. And then about 82, a gal buddy of mine, who I'd met at a psychic fair, gave me a copy of Spiral Dance by Starhawk. And it opened up another view, the goddess worship aspect of this. And that's pretty much how I got to be a witch. And then it just grew from there. Now, I was very much the mother priestess through the late 80s and 90s. And then, funny thing, I had a vision. I was invited to a shamanic thing out in the desert in 94 and got my spiritual butt handed to me on a platter, as they say. And I came back, barely knew my own name when I came back from New Mexico. And my name in those days, my craft name was Cassandra, Lady Cassandra. And the goofy thing about all of this was that about the only people who called me Cheryl was the IRS and my boss at my corporate job. And when I came back, I would call people up and say, "Hi, this is Cheryl," and everybody knew something was wrong. Okay. And so that had an effect on me. It led to me being taken to a Buddhist monastery. And at the Buddhist monastery, a Buddhist lama, the short story of Buddhist lama, was going through a handshaking line of about 150 people, and he got to me, shook hands with me, went into a European handshake with me with two hands, and got into my face and looked into my eyes, said, "I know you." That's a big deal with Tibetan lamas. And so I spent the next 7 years in Buddhist monastic life, and that taught me another view. And the funny thing was there were three of us, three Waken priestesses that were Buddhist nuns there, which was interesting. And the lamas were very respectful of us because they quite literally, when we were getting our ordination robes and being ordained, the lama that came from India sat up there and through a translator said, "Why do three daughters of the goddess want to become Buddhist nuns?" And we gave him a very intriguing answer. And he said, and basically what it amounted to, "You have compassion for the gods. You deserve to be Buddhist nuns." And that was the context of it. And that's how I got through that. And then at 7 years in that. And then one day I went to my lama and I told him what I had been on a singular assignment. They sent me someplace to open a center for them. And they were supposed to send another monastic, but nobody would come to where I was because it was up in New York State, and that's the frozen north, as people say. And nobody would come up there to help me. So I was doing the whole thing by myself. And one day I went to my lama, and I told him I'd had a realization. I explained to him what the realization was, and we talked it out. And he said, "What has this taught you?" I said, "Well, if I'm correct, I'm no longer qualified to be a Buddhist nun, because you can evolve out of that." And I did. So he told me, he said, "Why don't you go back to the pagan community? Don't try and convert anybody, but share the things they need to know." Mm-hmm. So that's what I've done. And then I came back. And there's a lot of, I don't want to call it Buddhist thought in my book, but there's a lot of the way I explain magical environment, I put the components that generally is not talked about in like something like Wicca. I put those Buddhist components in that kind of fill in the gaps.
So let me ask you, Cheryl, in your work, in your experiences through life, which sounds like to me you've had a lot of high strangeness happen to you.
Oh yes.
Can you give us a little insight to maybe some of the experiences that you've had with elementals, with the rock people, the tree people, the cloud people, the different elementals of fire and wind and water? Are there things that you could share with us? Because I know that you've had probably a lot of experiences in this area, have you not?
Yes. I think the only way I can really say it is I can be in the woods alone, but I am never alone.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I am never alone. And no matter where I am never alone. The clairvoyant side, it doesn't matter if it is passed on spirits. It doesn't matter if it's the nature spirits out here. In fact, that was one of the goofy things. There was one time we were at a pagan fest. This is about 1991 or 92. It was one of those El Nino years when it seemed like somebody turned on a faucet and all it did was rain. And we were at at this conference, and we were it was a campground, so Skyclad was perfectly okay. Okay, and a couple of the kids came to me and they said, "The showers aren't working." He said, "Well, let's just take a shower out in the rain." I said, "Go get a bowl from the camp stuff." This was our cooking stuff. "Go get a couple of big bowls and let them fill up with water." So we stepped out in the pouring rain, sat there and lathered up real good. I said, "Save your hair till last." So we lathered up, let the rain wash everything off. And then we started lathering up the hair. And that's when it stopped raining, because the rain divas have a sense of humor. And we had these bowls of water to rinse all the soap out of our hair. That's one of the best ones I can tell you about this. we have a running, I don't want to call it a running joke. My spouse is a hedge witch. And we go to places, and 9 times out of 10, there's the place is completely parked out, but parking fairies are always with me. Just for some reason, I always manage to get a prime parking place. Okay, so there's forces working around you. If you're friendly with them, they work with you. That's all I can say.
Well, I find that too. I do find that when you're in the stride of your magic, that other magics shows up to lead the way. Yeah, I can see that.
Constantly. Well, you know, there's one thing. Let me give you one more quick story.
Okay.
The monks, Buddhist monks and nuns, weren't much better than people I dealt with in the, these are Americans. They were all probably Presbyterians, Jews, or Baptists 20 years before. Okay, you have to keep that in mind, though now they were Buddhist, okay? And they didn't know what to make of me, and they didn't know what to make one of the other wicked priestesses. And so one night there was this big thing to do, a very big fire puja. This is like fire offering, where you're going to be offering like $300 or $400 worth of grains into the fire pit with, you know, cedar wood being burned with it to feed the ghosts and things. Okay. And they couldn't get a fire started because it was pouring down rain. This was that El Nino season again. Okay. And one of the elder nuns went up and told the visiting Lama what the deal was. And he said, my Buddhist name at that time was, my Buddhist name is Tashi. So Ani means nun or auntie. So they said, go get Ani Tashi. She knows how to deal with the weather spirits. She came and got me. I told her what I needed. She got me a couple bowls of rice. We borrowed one of the big horns out of the temple, one of those big Tibetan horns. And we went out in the front yard, and she had a big umbrella over both of us. I went through a gyration of things, made the offering of the rice, blew the horn a few times, and the rain stopped over the temple. Okay, the sky opened up over the temple. Blue sky, pouring every place else. And 20 minutes later, it closed up. By that time, they had a nice roaring fire going outside in the big fire pit. I mean, a huge fire, okay? The biggest mistake I ever made, never tell the weather spirits, and when our fire is going, feel free to do as you like. You should dismiss. Never tell them that. We got involved in the big fire puja ceremony and everything. And of course, inside as a Buddhist nun, I was like the fifth ranking down from the person who's actually up there waving the incense around. Okay. I'm just one of the flunkies. Okay. And the storm started up really bad. We started getting lightning, and the other wicked priestess was next to me, and we started having purple lightning and green lightning and yellow lightning. And she leaned into me and said, "What did you do?" And the next morning I got a phone call from a Cherokee medicine guy that I know, who's a lawyer and represented the native tribes in federal court, because everything that had to deal with the court always had to be with the Native Americans, had to be dealt with at a federal level. And he called me up the next morning, Big Bear, and he called me up. "So, were you out in Poolsville last night?" "Yeah." "Did you do weather magic?" "Yeah." "What did you do?" You know, so that gives you an idea that, you know, there are even an experienced person. At that point, I had over 20 years under my 25 years under my belt, and you're always still a student, you know, that type of thing. And I interrupted you, and I didn't mean to.
That's fine. I don't even remember what I was going to say, but
oh, I'm sorry.
I do know. I wanted to ask you if you have tuned in to past lives where you've worked with magic, where you've been with the druids, or you've been with the goddesses, or in
yes.
Greece and different places. Are those some of your memories?
Okay. I thought I could put my finger on through normal craft path, okay? But I did, when I first met that Lama who shook hands with me and said, "I know you," the other monks told me I should go in and visit him. So they gave me this like 15-minute appointment to go in and see him. I walked in with this notebook because I had come back from New Mexico, and I had been scribbling in it at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for 2 years. Right? And he looks at and he waves at me. I mean, they got me down on the floor bowing to the guy, and he said, "Get up, get sit in a chair." You know, so I'm sitting there in this lazy boy, and he says, "So what were you raised?" I said, "Well, I was raised Roman Catholic." "Oh, still Roman Catholic?" I said, no, I've been running with the Wicca shamans for the last 20 years. "Oh, still doing the yogi stuff, huh?" I said, "Do you mean I've done all this before? Are you good at it?" I said, "Yeah, I'm really good at it." He said, "You think you learned it all in one lifetime?" That pretty much says it all. 3 months later, me and the other Wicca priestess were ordained as Tibetan yogis. Because the Orthodox Tibetan tradition has both a traditional Buddhist path, and they also, the shamans of Tibet were the first ones converted to Buddhism. So they also have a tantric or what I'm going to call a magical path as well.
Okay. Oh, goodness. You've had such an exciting life, I can tell. And in your
book, $4, I can still buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Okay. All right. So tell us a little bit more about this book and why people should get a copy of it. What would be the headline that you'd want them to know about this book?
Well, most books that are out there, they get very verbose. This book's only got 140 pages in it. It's very small. Okay, but what I did was I went right to the non-sectarian juggler vein and taught basically the magical physics. You know, starting out with the idea that reality is pliable and bendable, okay? And then we go from there, and I do everything in non-sectarian terms. In fact, my goddess basically says, "Stop asking us for crap. You've got the same spark of life we've got. Do it yourself."
Yeah,
I get that. I get that. I'm getting that right from the lips of Isis on this thing. So, and you know, that's another thing people don't understand about pagan tradition is that we're not necessarily God fearing. We have a tendency to have that parent child relationship with our God deities, you know. And I find myself explaining that to non pagans a lot. It's a very interesting concept.
Very important. Very important.
I know we're out of time, probably.
Yes, no, I would like to pass you over to my co-host, Arielle.
Please.
She does have a switchboard, and if there's anyone that would like to speak to you, I'm sure that they'll be able to on your end, Arielle. So back to you,
okay.
Arielle. And Cheryl, anytime you want to come on our show and announce anything, especially when you get close to making things happen in Washington, D.C., come on, let us know about it so that we can always hold the point for what you're doing, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate that a great deal.
Okay. Okay, back to you, Ariel.
Okay. Well, you continue where we left off about how you've kind of gathered from all different views. And so what you put together in this book is drawing on all of your experiences and putting it in a way that, like you said, you're going right for the meat. So can we do just talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. Okay, first thing I want to qualify to your audience, because I have Wicca roots. I retired formally as a Wicca priestess in December of 2021. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 2020. And a lot of people think immediately if they don't know anything about Wicca, they think we're already, Wiccans are automatically wired into some particular deity. You pretty much have the flexibility of whoever you want, venerate whoever you want to. Okay. In the Wicca tradition, though, it appears by looking at a lot of the books, it seems to be mostly Greek pantheon, that kind of thing. I am a priestess of the goddess Isis. I believe in service, sacrifice, compassion, and love unto all things. And that's what I am about, and that also sort of dictates my moral code. Okay. The book primarily is about the idea of working with the machine code of reality, turning thought into form. Buddhist tradition teaches emptiness and form. Form is none other than emptiness. Emptiness is none other than form. And in this case, thought is none other than form. Form is none other than thought. Okay? And basically, all magical practices that you'll read about, whether you're doing candle magic, you pick the way you're doing it. It is about numbing down your conscious mind, getting yourself into the zone, sort of a meditative zone, whether you're doing it, drumming circles, whatever, getting yourself in this meditative zone and hopefully projecting a nonverbal cue to your younger self, that spark of life you have, which is connected to the force, connected to the dark womb, she, who is everything, and plugs you into that and do a manifestation. Okay. Now, a lot of people think we wiggle our nose and supper appears, you know, on TV, they should think that. And I have the hardest time explaining to people, no, it doesn't work that way. We nudge things. We nudge reality. We bend it a little bit. And a lot of people think you have to do these big, over-the-top rituals. And I tell them the best magic is as gentle as a baby's breath. Okay? You don't need to kick everything. You just need to whisper to it to make it happen, but be focused and clear of mind. And in our Western culture, that is very difficult. You can't walk into a restaurant anymore without there being four screens blaring some sports event.
Right.
You know, you got 90 different distractions coming in over a phone, and you look at your phone, yet people are bowing their heads to it like it's a deity 80 times a day. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And in the West, we have a problem with our too much chatter in our mind, and you cannot work effective magic unless you learn to quiet. And I teach my students to start at meditating 2 minutes a day for a couple of months, and then we maybe edge it up to 5 minutes a day. And ultimately, over the course of 6 to 8 months, I'd like them to be able to do 5 minutes three times a day. And that's the key, because once you can quiet the mind, then you can visualize, and then after that, it's just a matter of turning your thought into form.
So by going through this pattern of, you know, 2 minutes a day and then, you know, edging it up, that's just the training. Before you can do anything, you have to be able to do that. Is that?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And you know something? That's the hardest part of the magic. Because what happens when you start being alone with your thoughts, with all the weird stuff we have chattering around in our subconscious, all these sort of ghosts in our consciousness come up in front of us and it distracts us. Oh, my God, my boss yelling at me. Oh, my fifth grade teacher yelling at me. Oh, and this stuff just keeps coming up and people tell me, oh, it's just too hard. And you just have to let those, I call them meditative ghosts, they're not really ghosts, but meditative ghosts just go through you. They're vapor. They're dreams. Just let them evaporate. Just stand your ground. Don't fight it. Just let it go. Nagel taught me that in the monastery. Okay. Now, do you have to spend hours and hours in a temple someplace? No. I tell people the 2 minutes, you know, if you can't make time for yourself, do it during your lunch hour. You know, close the office door and give yourself 2 minutes, hit the timer on your watch or something like that, and do it. If you can't even carve the time out that way, do it 2 minutes on the throne during your lunch break in the restroom if you have to. Okay? Just be in a quiet place and just quiet your mind and be one with everything for that period of time. And then gradually edge it up. Now, a lot of people say, well, I can do 20 minutes. You might be able to close your eyes for 20 minutes, but I can't guarantee you're meditating for 20 minutes, okay? Because there's a lot to being alone with your thoughts and dealing with all this crap that comes up. You have to gradually weed it out in these 2 to 3 minute, up to 5 minute level of meditation. And thereafter, once you can get through 3, 4, 5 minutes worth of meditation without being burdened with all the subconscious chatter, then you can do longer periods. But even in the monastery, I never mastered more than 45 or 50 minutes. These days, no longer a monastic. I do 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes around lunchtime, and 5 minutes before I go to bed. That keeps me on a pretty even keel. I've also eliminated a lot of things that distract me. You know, I don't live on my phone. I have one, but I don't live on it like everybody else does.
Yeah, me either. You know, because there is so much coming through the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, frequency manipulation, let's call it that.
Yeah,
and
all
it's
that.
It's piggybacked on your conversation, and I often wonder, you know, I mean, what about if you're living in an area where there are cell phone towers, if people are arguing with each other and they're really, really mad, and all those bits of information are going through your body, whether you're on the phone or not, that's got to have some effect that,
yes,
that people just, they can't track it.
I agree.
You know? Why do I feel mad
much,
all of a sudden?
Too much electromagnetic radiation out there for my taste. And,
yeah,
I mean, I used to be a ham radio operator, and would you believe I retired all my ham radio gear over the last couple of years, and I gave my license back to the federal government. I don't do ham radio anymore. I don't need to be immersing myself in RF radiation.
Right. And those are just things that are taking your focus and your ability to just be still.
Yes. I think the biggest thing I communicate in the book is the idea of being, see, our Western culture, particularly Christian Judeo culture, has you think we're all separate from deity.
Right.
And to use Star Wars analogy, we are part of the Force. Our life force is part of the life force all through the universe, everywhere, every when. And I tell people, you know, you don't need to be sending, I know lots of people want to send spells and do a whammy on somebody they don't like, and I tell them, hey, don't monkey with that. It's not worth your trouble. They're not worth the trouble. Making offerings of great abundance for everywhere, every when, because there is blowback in magic. People tell you online, oh, there's no such thing, but they're trying, those same people are usually trying to sell you a piece of black magic as well. It's a $4 billion industry. And I tell people, you make generous offerings to the universe for the benefit of all beings, everywhere, every when, and the blowback is very positive for you. Okay. And
right.
You
well, and
be...
I mean,
go ahead.
Just whenever you interfere with someone else's free will, that's going to come back to you, you know. And if you try to manipulate beyond your right, you know, that's going to have a price tag.
Agreed.
On it.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed.
And it may be another lifetime when the bill comes in.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what they
get. Why did this happen to me? It's like,
they
well,
think
don't
it's like
you remember
Murphy's
100 years
it's
ago?
They're going to bite you next week. They think
right.
It's going to bite you next week. And they don't realize that, you know, you might, the result of something they just did is going to bite them in the next lifetime or two lifetimes from now. You know, we see these stories all the time where somebody's driving across some big expansive bridge over a river and a span falls away. Oh, why did bad things happen to good people? That's why. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, your karmic bank account, it carries over. It doesn't get closed out. When you start a new life, you bring all that forward. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's
not
exactly
interfering
it.
And always working for the good of all, you know, do no harm.
Exactly.
That's got to be the basic.
I go a step further with it. In my book, I said, you know, there are a lot of people that will say, well, I'm not Wiccan. I don't have to do that do no harm thing. Okay. And I impart in the book, quite literally, I says, you know, there's another piece of wisdom that I garnered in childhood, and it didn't come from my Catholic teachers. It came from Marvel Comics and the words of the late Stan Lee. You have a great, you know, what is it? Do the responsibility to do good things. If you've got the ability to do it, do good things. You have a responsibility to do so. And that's what I really try to impart to people is I'm not trying to be a goody two-shoes here, but there's enough hurt and want in the world that we should be doing our best to put something positive back into it. Stand, hold a line against the darkness, as they say.
Right. Well, by turning your own light up, you are vanquishing darkness, because the darkness is just the absence of the light. So
the more
we can turn our light up, which means being kinder, more compassionate, not judging, not manipulating, and you know, doing all those negative things, that just adds to the collective light, which vanquishes the dark, because the dark just hadn't been exposed to the light yet.
Thank you. You're dead on it. And also in the book to some degree, I explain the idea of connecting to, again, use a Star Wars term, the term the Force, okay?
Right.
I was hesitant to say it the way I really wanted to say it, thinking it might turn people off. So I kept it very neutral. If I had said it the way I wanted to say it, it would have been, I am she who is black. I am she who is white. I am she who is nothing. I am she who is all things. I am she who is pregnant with universes. I am she. She is within me. She and I are one.
Well, that's beautiful.
And I learned that sort of thing, that the universe, the deeper I got into my meditations, I mean, I always expected God and goddess kind of attitude and the celebration of the Greek goddess. But it wasn't until I was in deeper meditation retreats in my Buddhist life, my monastic life, that I realized the great consciousness, the Force, is feminine. And all other things that we might attribute to it are just, she is everything anyway. So, but it is fundamentally feminine. And so that's just kind of how I wanted to say it. But I had a test version of it, and one of the editors pushed back and said I might turn off an awful lot of people by claiming it's not a balance of both. Okay, and that was other than grammar edits and things, that was the only thing that I adjusted a bit.
I guess it's something they call politically correct, but
yes.
Certainly people can read between the lines. Well, I've got a comment from our producer, one of our producers, Fiona. And I want to say hey to Jada, and I hope you had a happy birthday last week. So you're going to talk to Fiona. Let me open up your mic, sweetie.
Go ahead, Fiona, please.
Okay. All right, Fiona, you're on.
Hi, Carol. Hi, Ariel. What I just heard you say was a very, very good about polarity. And if you could just clarify for me and for our listeners, that polarity isn't for witches all light or all dark. Polarity is a middle ground where we stay balanced, and I feel, I feel as if a dry ice can burn you and heat can burn you, and so everything is a polarity of balance rather than a one
extreme
way or another. Could you just extrapolate a little bit about polarity for me?
Okay, as somebody who was raised as a boy person, polarity was a very awkward thing for me, because I felt it wasn't so much my drives as much as how I identified, okay, and my connection to and the femininity. And people say, I had a lot of people, particularly men, saying, Join the service. It'll make a man out of you. You know, go to war. It'll make a man out of you. I volunteered for Vietnam. Okay. And it was my feminine instincts that got me out of there alive. And I don't say that to an awful lot of people, but that was the case. Polarity is reality, but ultimately, like I said, she is all things. She is everything. But she is feminine. The force is feminine in nature if you listen to it. Okay, and you have to quiet yourself and feel it and understand it. I think the only reason I hate to go here, but our whole history, feminine people like Mary, Jesus's mother, they were magical workers. Okay, and they were part of a society of women who could manifest the forces by weaving them, okay? And if she, her virgin birth was a result of a magical weaving, and there's documentation out there about this. And so you have a history where the men had to be in, felt they needed to be in charge, so they did everything they could either to kill off all the enlightened women and to breed the rest of the women that came after that to pure timidity. And I'm quoting Amelia Earhart right there. Women have been bred for timidity for generations, but the women are the stronger when you really boil it down to that. We're made to feel like we have to protect the women. They aren't actually much more fierce than people give them credit for. Okay. Men may have the brute strength, but women are far stronger in other ways. So, as they say with feminine, with childbirth, you know, most men probably would never survive it. I've held a lot of women's hands in childbirth, okay, and as a clergy person, and I really truly thought my hand would be broken by the end of it. So, but the bottom line is there is balance in the universe. Okay, there is a balance. And it's important to keep that balance. It's important to keep it both in the universe, in our society, and also within ourselves. And everything in our society seems geared up to throw that balance off. And that's one of the insidious parts about all of this.
I think Fiona had to call back in.
Okay.
All right, that was weird. But anyway, so my question is more to the fact that a lot of people associate the light with good and the darkness with bad. And we've just come up upon Imulg, where we have in the darkness the seeds germinating the new light. New life that does reach for the light, and there's a very much of a balance there.
Yes.
So a lot of times people say, oh, only the light, only the light, only the light. And I just have an issue with that. I feel like people need to realize that a lot happens in the darkness that germinates the food that feeds them even. That's what I... Can you
extrapolate
on that?
I would agree. We never dreamed in a gazillion years there would be life at the bottom of the ocean in all that dark by volcanic vents and 800-degree water.
Mm-hmm.
We never dreamed
mm-hmm.
there was there. Life, to steal a line from Jurassic Park, life finds a way. You know,
yes.
And the bottom is that too many people say, oh, it's got to be light, it's got to be light. You know, no.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Gray. Okay, the balance is gray. Okay,
mm-hmm.
and only when you get out of balance is there sometimes a problem. It's okay to have all light, but like you said, you have to have the dark for the germination. You have to have
mm-hmm.
dark for some, in order for, think about this, for the nocturnal animals.
Yes.
Okay, if we had,
yes.
say, Jupiter turn into a sun like we saw in 2010 movie, okay? Mm-hmm. It would affect the nocturnal animals because there would be light during even the dark hours. And that would be a big deal. That would be damaging. So
you have
to have a balance of both. You really do.
Right. Okay, thank you for that. I just wanted a clarification on between light and darkness. I think there's different meanings and purposes of that depending on what the inculcation is on the belief system. But I do believe that with witches, there is a definite polarity thing that goes on. And I loved your interpretation of how the goddess has come to serve. I believe it is her time now, and she will be coming forth. Period.
Absolutely. One of the goofy things that I've dealt with recently, we've seen with the thing going on in Ukraine, we've seen veterans that were from like the Iraq War and from Afghanistan mm-hmm. going over to help. Okay. And I've mm-hmm. had people come to me, well, you're a combat veteran. Why don't you go help? I said, one, I'm 70 years old in about 3 weeks. I would only get in the mm-hmm. way. And at this point in the game, it's sort of, excuse my expression, against my religion at this point, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean I can't help. Okay? Now, me, mm-hmm. okay, what do I do?
Yeah.
I've got magic. Now, I'm not going to do anything lethal. I don't believe in that. Okay? But that didn't mean that, gee whiz, those Russian tanks. There's nothing wrong with doing a little bit of monkey wrench magic on those things and affecting the electronics in them. And what have we been seeing recently? They're all bogged down in the mud. They're quitting. They're running out of fuel. They're breaking. I think the magic worked a little bit.
Well, listen, if we can bend a spoon, we can certainly throw a monkey wrench in something.
The electronics in those things is delicate as heck. And, and I figured, that's where I'm going to throw the monkey wrench because those tanks, those mini-ton tanks don't do very well when that delicate electronics poops out. And my attitude is, I just direct my forces into the reality of those electronics.
Yes, that is so, and don't you know, so, okay, on that note, since you have followed the UFO for so long as well, do you think there was intervention because we as witches are throwing a monkey wrench as well, but what about the aliens in their craft, the ones that might be cheering for our side of the game? What do you think could be going on there?
I don't know if they're interfering directly. I think it's against the rules for them mm-hmm. to do that.
Yeah.
But they're monitoring very closely from everybody I know that's in the business associated with observing that and being aware of what's going on. There's higher activity there. They seem to be observing. I think what they're mm-hmm. very concerned about is that excuse the expression, the monkey boys might let the nukes loose.
Yes.
Okay, and I think if local tactical nukes were utilized back in the 80s, we almost had a couple of exchanges then, and the off-worlders shut the silos down.
Yes, I remember.
Okay,
that.
And I think that's why they're there now. They're watching the local as they say the local nuclear guns. They're looking at those local tactical missiles and things, and I think they're monitoring that situation very closely. And I think that I don't think they want this thing to evolve much further than it is, and it's very risky.
Yes. It is in both cases, and in their assessment of it and our dealing with it, because we've had many killed, and it's like at what point what is the tipping point for intervention?
Well, okay, let's look at intervention. Before that war started, people were saying why, back this around 2019-2020 time frame, people were saying how come there seem to be more UFOs right now. And if you were to look at my charts in the last 20 years, from 2001 to 2020, we had 167,632 UFO sighting reports. Only one in 258 people reports what they see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
exactly.
20% of the American public has said in polls that they have seen something, but it doesn't correspond to the ones that have been reported. Okay?
Yes. Understood.
So I think the bottom line is a lot of us thought before COVID thought the tipping point might be the fact that we were getting more and more and more sightings. People talk about mm-hmm. the UFOs, oh, like the 40s, 50s, and 60s were the, you know, it's like an FM radio station, the best hits from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And we've had, okay, from 1960 to 2000, there were 13,156 total sighting reports for that 40-year period. Now, 13,156, okay, for that whole 40-year period. I've got that many for 2012, 2013, and 2014 on individual years. 13, 14,000 in those individual years. And we're peaking, we're heading back towards a peak again. And a lot of us seem to think we might be at the ecological tipping point where if our governments don't give us disclosure, ET is going to do it.
They will. Okay.
And there's another point with the ET. Okay. Everybody, there's a Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation interviewed about 4,500 people who had been touched by ET, abducted, that kind of thing. And while they all had similar experiences, they all had different experiences. But one common thing they all had, they told us, one, take care of our planet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
two, all the people, no matter what they were, if they were agnostic, they came back spiritual. If they were hellfire and brimstone Bible thumpers, they came back spiritual.
Amazing.
As a quote from the director of the Institute there, Ray Hernandez, it seems like ET is trying to turn us all into mystics.
I see. Yes. Okay. Interesting.
So when you see a UFO sighting, it's a bit of a spiritual experience, and it expands your view of reality, which is what's necessary. And people who do magic have their view of reality expanded.
Yes. It seems to crack open reality boxes for sure.
Oh, for sure.
And I've definitely had UFO sightings of my own, as have you, I'm sure. And then I have another question then. So if the UFOs are coming, have you seen a cadence, a pattern of when the occurrences have happened? I was wondering about their travel and how they would come here. And, you know, I know that they're going up, but it seems to me in the past that they had a cadence of a certain number of years. Did you
yes.
see any of that
it's
in your research?
It's a 6 to 8 year window, typically about 7 years. And if you were to look at it over the last 60 years, there's like a, it looks mm-hmm. like a little snake crawling across the lawn, hump, up, down, up, mm-hmm. hump, up and down, up and down, up and down. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a humpiness to it. And a lot of people, in fact, in 2013, the numbers started falling off rather radically, about 30% a year. And all the sightings tanked.
Pretty significant, though. Very.
It tanked. 2017, the sighting numbers were in the toilet. Okay.
Okay.
And everybody was saying, oh, I got all kinds of, I was still writing my newspaper column about UFOs. And mm-hmm. I had a 7-year column that I wrote, a weekly column about UFOs, okay, for a regular newspaper. And people were telling me, oh, the Space Force chased them away, or this chased them away, or they went home, they're bored with us. You know, I heard every excuse you can shake a stick at. I kept trying to tell them this is part of a normal cycle. Okay, and they'll be back. Trust me, they'll be back. I took 2019 off from working on UFO stuff other than my column because the numbers mm-hmm. were in the toilet, and I figured they'll be back in a year or two. In spring of 2020, I get a phone call from a reporter out in Nevada who's an expert as well, and he said, hey, my phone's ringing off the hook. And I said, I've been on sabbatical, so let me check. So I got some numbers from one of the national reporting services, dropped it into my mathematical model, and I said, hey, unless something changes, we're going to have the best year since 2012.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it turned out exactly that way.
It's starting to come.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It took, the numbers took off.
Okay.
And there's another issue. The leisure time is a big issue. Okay, most of the sightings happen, 68 to 75% of the sightings happen between 5 o'clock, 5:30 at night and 11:30 at night, with the bulk of it between 8:30 and 10:30. Okay? That's where the bulk of the sightings are. And but leisure time is a driver as well. And a lot of people heard me on Coast to Coast AM say that, and they said, wait a minute, we're getting ready to go into lockdown. You've got a perfect natural laboratory here to check this. And March and April of 2020, the numbers were through the roof during lockdown.
Okay. Yeah, wow. That's amazing. And so I wonder what the correlation is between the pandemic and the people staying home. And then, you know, people staying home could be buying binoculars or just doing anything to see the goose on the lake, and then they happen to see, you know, more than they expected. I think that the UFOs do cloak a bit, and so that people are staying home and seeing this, it'll be interesting to chart the statistics when we're through this. I mean, we're coming out of this, I think, maybe, and to see where the numbers go. But when people are attending to what is going on, clearly you have been tracking and see that that did go up when people have that time to be looking at it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I tell a lot of people that the whole lockdown period was put the whole world in a monastic moment when you think about it.
Yeah, isn't that great? Really, kind of? Wow. Well, it's been very, very enjoyable discussing that with you. I'm going to give you back to Arielle. Thanks for asking all my questions. I really appreciate it. See you being on the show tonight. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Fiona.
You're welcome.
Talk to you after. Bye-bye.
So where do you want to go with this?
Okay. Well, we're kind of getting ready to wrap it up.
We don't
have any other, as far as I can tell, we don't have anybody else on here that has a question. So this has just been very, very informative. I'm not an expert on Wicca like Fiona, but excuse me. But I do understand that the principles. And I like the way that you put it, you know, talking to the younger self and hooking it together with the higher self. It kind of like takes everything that you are and puts it in one place.
Well, I make a big point in the book of saying the talking self here is just a meat sock. You know, it's just a costume we wear to live in reality, you know, and that's it. The real essence of who we are is that spark that connects us to everything. And it's not separate. We are connected to everything, everywhere, every when. And I had to do a chapter in there because I've had people ask me about this. This is, well, does that mean if we're really meditated down, can we reach out and touch an alien 39 light years from now? And I said, theoretically, yes. But there's some hindrances, you know, are you quiet enough, you know, there's a number of things you have to take into consideration, but technically, yes, we can touch anything, anywhere, any temporal reference in the universe, because she connects us to everything.
And that's really, I mean, that's the basic premise that we have to, the consideration that we are separate and that we are like inferior from the higher source.
Yes.
That's, I think, a false programming from organized religion, because, I mean, you know, why would they tell us that we have any power? Because then we might not come to church and you know, make the donations. So,
mainstream faiths have been losing share for a long time. Okay, the county I moved from in upstate New York, Onondaga County, in upstate New York, the Syracuse area. They've had to close about 12 churches in the last 10 years, okay? And they were all mainstream churches, okay? I sat on the, as a Wicca priestess, I sat on the local council of churches as a guest member of the local council of churches. They're pretty much with all the Abrahamic faiths. And, you know, when I first went there, they were like, do you people have a God? And I said, yeah, we got him by the bushel, you know? And I'm there in a black clergy shirt like them, but I've got a green collar, okay? And once they figured out that as clergy, I did the same things they did, and I held the hands of the dying. I blessed the babies. I married people. Once they understood I was doing the same things they were, and I wasn't a devil worshiper, they were pretty cool, especially when I started pitching in with all – they started drafting me into all these committees and things. So I was a hard worker for them as well. So we've got a lot in common, and I have to do a – Pride Day speech, Pagan Pride Day speech at this August here for the Cleveland Pagan Pride Day. I was really quite flattered. I only lived here about 3 months. My tone, my flavor is we are all one. We are all one. If I look out into that audience of people and I look at all of you, it doesn't matter what faith you are, what face of God you venerate, all I see is the great consciousness looking back at me, and what do we have? The great consciousness looking at itself, or she is looking at herself.
Wow. Yeah, and truly being at one with all that is.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And organized religion is on the, it's on the way out, or it has to change quite a bit to remain, because people are becoming more spiritual.
Yeah, very much so. One
yeah,
quick,
and
note,
that's
one
a good
quick,
thing.
One quick one you'll like, because I was a member of this clerical group. We had some kind of an award ceremony going to go on. It was over at some apostolic church there in town. And I got over there, my spouse and I came in, and I went up to one of the reverends who was like the coordinator for it. And I said, hey, Frank, is there anything I can do? It was pouring down rain outside. Okay. Please understand, it is pouring down rain outside. He just looks at me and he says, could you do something about the rain? I said, I'm on it. Went outside, did my little rain dance in the parking lot, and it stopped. And two of the women clergy were standing on the porch under umbrellas there on the steps of the church and said, that was a neat trick. I walked in. Hey, Frank, anything else you need? I took care of the rain. And he glanced out the window and he glanced back at me. I think we got it covered. And that story got around the rest of the clergy. So they were very, let us say, respectful thereafter. It was then I started getting invited on committees, invited to clergy dinners, that type of thing. So it took a lot to show them that while I did the same things they did, I do it from a different perspective and I'm connected differently. That's all.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, and you wouldn't be able to do what you do if you weren't connected like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's also a demonstration that anybody, everybody has that within them.
Yes.
But most people don't believe it, have been taught not to believe it. And
they've been taught to be scared of it, too.
Yeah.
Hollywood has perpetuated that image for years. You know, to touch this is, you're touching the devil, you know, all that stuff. And it's not.
Yeah. Well, that just goes back to the earliest parts of Christianity, because that was the main, the main competition. So they had to turn it into evil.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did a documentary in college about that. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm there with you.
Yeah.
So that's basically it. That's what the book is. It's so I can, may I make, give a plug real quick?
Oh, sure, yeah. You want me to do it?
No, I can do it here. Magical Musings of a Rogue Witch. My name is Cheryl Costa. That's Cheryl with a C, Costa with a C. And if you go to Amazon and do the book search and just put in Cheryl Costa, you'll probably see Witch come up or something like that. You plug it in there and you'll see the book. It's very affordably priced, and it's only $12.99. It's like only 10 pounds over in England. I sold more copies in England than I did before I started seeing it in the States. It was interesting. So,
Well, could be that, you know, the Celtic influence over there. So, well, that is, yes, you just go to Amazon, and if you put, you know, Cheryl Costa in the search bar, or even Rogue Witch, I'm sure that would still come up.
Yeah, well, if you put Cheryl Costa by itself, you'll get UFO books too. So,
oh, well, that's right. That's right, because you've got a lot to offer. And we're really thrilled that you were able to be with us tonight. And
do you know
certainly,
what the next project is?
Pardon? What's your next project?
It's 80 books. And remember the UFO desk reference only went down to the county level. We couldn't do one that went down to like the zip code or municipal level, city level. And the reason we couldn't do that was because the book would be 6,000 pages, literally. So we decided to do an individual book for every individual, every state, right down to the city level. Total detail down to the city level. So it'll be 50 books and 50 state books and 29 UFO shapes books where we're plotting maps in there showing you where the shapes are by zip code. Okay.
Wow.
And it will, when we are done with it, we're doing about a book a week right now. Okay. We're building them one time at a time. Not a lot of literary goes into them. You know, it's mostly charts, graphs, tables, things like that. But, when we get done, we'll have a total of about 80 books, and it will be the largest compilation of compiled, analyzed UFO statistics ever published in human history. And
oh, wow.
By a couple of witches.
Kudos to you and your partner.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like you said, it's information. It's facts. It's you can't deny that. So they're like nonfiction books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
And the State University of New York at Albany, back in November before I moved to Cleveland, they took my papers, both as an activist, a trans activist back in the 80s and a witch activist in the early 90s. They took 25 crates of my papers, and it's in the archives. That basically is immortal, so to speak. And all the UFO, as we publish all these UFO things, we send them whatever they got, you know, whatever we've got. And they're adding to the collection. But the witch book is part of this collection now. And a lot of my mystical writings are part of their collection now, stuff that's not published. So, hell, they got my grimoire. Okay, so this university has this archive of a 21st century witch, and I'm very proud of that.
Wow. Well, that's quite the accomplishment, and it's also an affirmation that there's going to be, what is the word, going forward, longevity. It's going to be there.
Yes.
For future generations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's
well,
the hope.
Excellent. Excellent.
This has been fun. Thank you for having me on.
Yes. Oh, it has been our pleasure, Cheryl, and you're welcome anytime to come back when you have an announcement to make or you got something new coming out. Just, you know, send an email to Lavendar, and we'll look forward to speaking with you again at some point.
Okay. Anytime, anywhere.
Okay. Okay. Thanks so much, Cheryl Costa. So that is it for us tonight, boys and girls. We will be back 2 weeks from tonight with another show. So in the meantime, make sure you hold gratitude in your heart and give compassion instead of judgment. Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.